Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
Il me fait plaisir d'introduire maintenant Judith Lichtenberg, who is a professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. Before moving to Georgetown in 2007, she taught at the University of Maryland, and she has held visiting position at Yale and Harvard, among many others. In 2005 and 2006, she was a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center at the Stanford University, of course. She is the editor of a book called Democracy and the Mass Media, and author of many articles. She is currently writing a book entitled Charity, Its Scope and Limits.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me, and I'm sorry I can't speak in French. My French isn't good enough. I'm even sorrier that I can't follow the other talks as well as I would like, to say the least, and I hope I'm not either just repeating or contradicting things that have just been said. Luckily, I'm early on. If I were speaking tomorrow afternoon, I'd be more worried about this. My talk actually departs somewhat from the title and the abstract that I submitted months ago, and I want to apologize for that in a way, but, you know, what can you do? You know, you start thinking about things, and, you know, your thought leads you in directions you hadn't necessarily anticipated. So I had planned to talk about the relationship journalists have with a variety of other groups, employers, sources, the public. The public itself is a complex idea. Does it mean the audience for a particular medium they work for or organization? Is it a larger public, a national public, an international public? And my idea was to talk about the possibility that there are conflicts between these different groups, and journalists have fiduciary relationships with one or the other, and how do they adjudicate these conflicts? These are very difficult questions, and I don't mean at all to say that they're not important, but in thinking more about these issues, I came to realize that for the purposes I'm interested in, maybe it doesn't matter that much, because what I really want to say is that the journalist's primary responsibility is to the truth. It sounds very grand and also maybe somewhat obscure, and let me explain what I mean here. So it seems to me that we as citizens and as human beings, we're faced with this buzzing, blooming riot of a world out there, you know, just tons of stuff going on, and we need to understand it for our role as citizens and also for our role as human beings. And, you know, we know almost nothing about the world firsthand, contrary to what your mother told you. Don't believe what other people tell you. You got to find out for yourself. You know, almost everything we know as hearsay. And so it better be good hearsay. And I think the reporter's job is to help us make sense of this chaos and confusion, to sort out fact from fiction, truth from rumor, to figure out what's going on. At least one kind of journalist, that is. There are different kinds of journalists. But the reporter of events, that's what his or her job is, to help us sort out truth from fiction and make sense of this buzzing, blooming confusion out there. Now, some people will think this is a very naive view. they'll take issue that we should speak about, with the idea that we should speak about the truth or that there is a truth for journalists to tell. So we have these challenges from subjectivists, relativists, postmodernists, who reject the idea of objective truth and the idea that there's a reality out there to be discovered. Now, I think this view is not as fashionable as it was maybe 20 years ago. Maybe as the world has gotten more frightening, we don't have time for these kinds of ideas. But I think it still holds sway in a lot of places. So I want to say a little bit more in defense of what do I mean by truth and why this isn't a naive idea. I think the skeptics are right that talking about truth can make complicated things seem too simple. So let me say a little bit more about that. I mean, some truths are simple and straightforward. There are simple facts that Barack Obama is president of the United States. Some might think those are trivial, but I think once you allow that there are facts of any kind, you've already punched some, weakened the postmodern view. Some will also be disappointed to hear that I'm identifying truth with facts. Mere fact seems so trivial, truth seems so grand. I guess I'm not talking about truth with a capital T. I'd be very happy to find truth with a small t. And it may be that truth can't always be identified with facts, but I think lots of times it can. So sometimes there are simple facts which are undeniable. There is truth that we don't know about. Is there advanced life in other galaxies? And, you know, this is what we want reporters for, is to help us figure out the truths that we don't know are truths. Of course, sometimes the idea of truth doesn't make sense. We have the idea that there's a distinction between facts and values. Facts are true, and values are neither true nor false. I'm not a proponent of that view myself, and I think a lot of people aren't. A lot of other people aren't either. Most of us take some value judgments even to have truth value. The idea, for example, that slavery is wrong, most of us would say that that's true. Slavery is wrong. So even the realm of facts isn't necessarily limited to the realm of, or the realm of truth isn't necessarily limited to the realm of positivist facts. It may include values as well. But clearly the truth about the sorts of issues that are facing us in the world today are often multifaceted and complex, and speaking of the truth can be highly misleading at best. Sorting out what's going on in the Middle East, not to mention what ought to be going on in the Middle East, and how to describe what is going on, you know, to speak of the truth would be misleading. So truth isn't always a helpful concept here. I think part of the difficulty comes, you know, if we think about the courtroom dictum to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Most of the time we can tell the truth if we want, and much of the time we can tell nothing but the truth. But it's almost impossible for a journalist or anyone else to tell the whole truth. There's just too much to tell. And this is true both if you think about the dilemmas of journalism about what stories to tell, and once you've chosen a story, what facts to include in telling the story. So on the one hand, to leave out important truths is not to tell the whole truth, even if one has not said anything false. So if you just say what's true, but you leave out important facts, you've left out, you haven't told the whole truth, and you've distorted the story. I think this problem affects the decision about what stories to tell at least as much as how to tell them. The economic and political interests of news organizations can have a huge impact, as we know, on which stories get told and which don't, and also on how they get told. So the journalist and the news organization have to select from the vast array of possible stories, and given a story, a vast array of possible facts, what to tell and how to tell them. Nevertheless, despite these all these complications. What seems absolutely clear to me is that the reporter has to take the idea of truth, the search for truth, the possibility of truth as a guiding ideal, that if even if that's impossible, it is an ideal. It's something you approach but you never arrive at. I think a journalist who doesn't take that as the ideal is going to fall short. So you have to aim, the journalist has to aim, as we all do, to get at the truth, to shed our biases, to be objective, even if we never quite get there. Now, of course, you might say, well, no one's objective. And that's no doubt true, that no one can completely shed their biases and leave their perspective behind. But nevertheless, it seems to me that that this has to be your aim, and you have to do what you can to get beyond your biases. So is objectivity the same as neutrality? Often they've been equated in discussions of the role of the journalist. And I think that's a mistake. Neutrality means not taking a position. Objectivity means not starting out with a preconceived idea and being open to finding out what's the case. But once you have investigated a set of issues, you might very well, as a journalist or as a human being, come to have a certain position because you think the facts, the truth is out there, and you now know what it is. So to be neutral is to be agnostic, and that's not necessarily... Agnosticism may not be warranted by what you find out there. Now, this brings me to the issue of balance, because often in discussions of media ethics, it's often said that journalists, they ought to be neutral, and the way you achieve this is by balance. You tell both sides of the story or all sides of the story. And you don't take a position yourself. And so I want to take a few minutes to think about why is it thought that balance is an appropriate stance? Why should journalists be balanced? It seems to me there are at least three reasons. One is epistemological, the idea that, well, if you don't know what the truth is about a set of issues, then you present both sides of the story and you ask different experts to weigh in. The second is ethical, and I guess this is the idea that in a democracy, people are supposed to make up their own minds. It's not for the journalist to tell us how things are. The journalist is going to present us with the possibilities, and people are supposed to make up their own minds. And, of course, this goes with the idea, I think, that the journalist should be neutral because to have a view is not to be objective, which, I think is a mistake because if the journalist has investigated an issue, the journalist may be in a very good position to say what the truth is. A third reason for taking balance as central is political, because it's taken that contradicting certain sources may be politically unwise. If the President of the United States says X, then for the journalist to contradict what that statement openly would be politically unwise, at least, and might seem unduly confrontational. So there's several different reasons why balance has been taken to be an appropriate stance for the journalist. But I think it's problematic. So take, as an example, discussions of climate change. I was struck watching Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth on TV the other day again. He says, and again, this is just hearsay. I haven't looked into this as much as I should to know what's behind it. But he claims in the film that all 900 scientific articles on climate change that he consulted when at the time of the film three years ago agreed on its significance and that it was human-caused, he said. So he said all 900, now again, the implication was he looked at all the articles that were there, and they all agreed that climate change was human-caused and significant. But he claimed that media coverage showed that it was about half and half. A little, you know, it was evenly divided. That journalists made it seem as if this view was much more controversial than it actually is within the scientific community. And I guess this actually makes one realize that there's a fourth reason why journalists take balance to be evaluated. It makes things more interesting. I mean, what fun is it to say that everybody agrees that climate change is happening and it's a bad thing and it's human caused? It's more interesting to have controversy. So, for example, 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, I guess it is now, the cover story of the New York Times Magazine was about Freeman Dyson, the noted physicist extraordinaire in his 80s now, who's a skeptic about climate change. There was very little in this article delving into whether he's right, what his evidence is, whether this is actually his expertise at all. But the idea is this: rock star physicist is a skeptic of climate change, and that's kind of fun and interesting. So balance can be highly misleading, and yet we can see why it's taken to be, why it's taken to be important, and why in some circumstances it is a value. So I've been talking so far in very general terms, and what I've been saying doesn't really take account of the changing landscape of media and news. And so I want to turn to that and try to put these remarks in the context of the present day. So first, just let's look at this from the point of view of the so-called consumer of news and information, although I don't like that way of talking about it. So to go back to where I began, the blooming, buzzing confusion of the world. I mean, there is always a lot happening out there. Is there actually more happening than there ever was? I don't know. But at the very least, it's clear that now there's an enormous amount of information, if that's what it is, about what's happening out there. And it's just staggering. And I'm sure as writers and students and intellectuals, I don't need to tell you that the problem is overload, and we're just overwhelmed by all the information out there and how to sort through it. And I live in Washington, where you have to read the Washington Post, but you also have to read the New York Times. So just to every morning to go out and find these two enormous newspapers. I mean, I don't read them the way I should. I read the fun stuff more than I should, and the serious stuff less than I should. But there's that, and the internet, and it's just staggering. And so the question, even more than there ever was, is how to make sense of this blooming, buzzing confusion. How do you figure out whom to trust, which information is good? I mean, the truth may be out there, but where? And journalists are our filters, our consolidators. It seems to me they have to do part of the work for us, because that's their job. It's not, we have our jobs. Their job is sort of to sort through all the stuff out there and help us figure out what's true. Now, obviously, if that's going to work, we're putting an enormous amount of trust in journalists, and journalists would have to deserve that trust. And you might ask, well, is it wise or rational to trust anyone that much? Especially since even in the best of circumstances, journalists and the organizations they work for have interests and biases that may be at odds with getting at the truth. And this was always true. You can never just believe what you read. You have to be skeptical and wonder about the interests of those purveying this information. Even if you think that the journalist, him or herself, is a person of great integrity. So, in one sense, it seems like, no, you can't just trust anyone, even in the best of circumstances. And so the good citizen and the good thinker really ideally ought to spend a lot of time evaluating the sources from which she gets information. But who has time to do that? So these problems and the problem of information overload are inextricably intertwined with the economics of the media today. There was a survey in the Atlantic magazine, I think this month or last month, surveying some noted journalists, and one of them wasn't mentioned by name, but says, the internet has mortally wounded the financial structure of the news business so that the cost of doing challenging independent reporting has become all but prohibitive all over the world. So newspapers haven't figured out how to make money in this new era, as we know, and, you know, it's shocking that even newspapers like the Washington Post, you know, the second most or third, counting the Wall Street Journal, most important, largest paper in the U.S., you know, is cutting back enormously, even cutting back the comics. I think the sports section will be the last to go, but... Now, this isn't an entirely new problem. Newspapers have been in increasing financial trouble for several decades, even before the internet. And in a recent article in the Nation, John Nichols and Robert McChesney argue that it goes back to, you know, when the 70s, when corporate ownership and media consolidation took off, and that's when media owners began looking at the bottom line and cutting news budgets and closing bureaus. And so this is not simply a matter of the internet. But from the point of view of the consumer, you know, we're certainly aware of it in those terms. And the pace of the problem has accelerated with the rise of the internet. Now, you might think, well, so what's the problem? Because now we have so many more sources. Who cares about these newspapers? There are so many people writing about events, from, you know, the large news organization to the lone blogger, of which there seem to be billions of people who have nothing else to do but just write every minute whatever comes into their head. I mean, now that may sound good for democracy. I mean, let 1,000 flowers bloom, 1,000,000 flowers bloom, but it probably isn't. Because even though we may have good reasons to distrust even the most respectable sources whose organizations have vested interests that give rise to biases of various kinds, even though we have good reason to distrust even them, how much worse if we know nothing about the source that we're reading? And, you know, it's hard to avoid this. You know, you want to find something out. You go on the internet. My students do this all the time, you know, and they found a source. So they can, you know, they can say, okay, here, I found this on the internet. I mean, who is this person writing this? Or even if it's not a person, an organization, there's absolutely no check on their credibility. How are we going to separate the truth from the chaff? How can we know, you know, which writers out there are committed to truth and objectivity and other journalistic values? And, you know, it's not just enough to be committed to it. You have to be in a position to follow up on that. So there's a blurring of the line in the blogosphere, between fact and fiction, but also between fact and opinion. And getting at the truth is only getting harder. So there's a worry by many that the economic difficulties of the media will mean that firsthand investigative reporting is going to decline radically, and I think it already has. And as a result, we're not going to get multiple accounts of events, as one writer puts it, precisely because reporters are imperfect, because they, by necessity, capture only a fragment of reality. It's essential that numerous firsthand accounts exist. If instead of several accounts of what's going on in China, say, we only have one AP, Associated Press, for example, readers will be forced to accept that one version without being able to compare it. And, you know, that version might be put alongside of some blogger out there who knows who that person is. So we're even less likely to get at the truth than we once were. Well, what is to be done? I've run out of time, and my suggestions are probably not as good as other people speaking at this conference. So I'm going to leave that question to some of our other panelists, who I'm hopeful will have some creative ideas. Thank you.
So thanks a lot for this great presentation. So once again, we have 15 minutes, and we are recording. So if you can identify yourself before asking a question, that would be great. So the floor is open.
Thank you. Can you I assume you can hear me. Look, Ian Richards from the University of South Australia. Judith, just a question. Should governments regulate to encourage the sort of journalism that helps the audience sort out the buzzing, blooming world? Or do you leave it to the free market to work that out?
Well, I would say there has to be... the previous speaker discussed some of the ambiguities in the about the term regulation, and I'm not sure I understood her entirely. But I think some sort of regulation in the sense of some assistance from the government, subsidies of some kind. I don't think leaving it to the free market is the solution. Although, you know, how you have government play a role without, you know, bringing the threat of censorship and government control is the difficult question.
Hi, my name is Andrew Potter, and I'm a news editor with the Ottawa Citizen, which is a paper which is owned by CanWest. Which is owned by CanWest, a company that's got
the Ottawa Citizen.
The Ottawa Citizen, yeah, it's a paper in Ottawa. And one of the things I realized, I used to be an academic, and once I moved into journalism, I kind of found something really interesting when I started working with some of my writers. I'd never set foot in a newsroom before I got this sort of job as a news editor, and everyone's like, what are you doing here?
I'm impressed. Maybe you can tell us how to go about this.
One of the interesting things that I sort of found for working with my writers, it took me months before I found out what they were doing when they were building stories and so on, and what I sort of realized was, and I came into the business sort of thinking, well, this is almost like applied philosophy in a sense. It's philosophy about the world, right? We because like philosophers, which I used to be, we seek the truth, right? And that's what reporters are doing. But there's a crucial distinction, which it's not a challenge. It's sort of a to fill in sort of what you're saying, which is that we're after a certain kind of truth, which is the public record. Because there is, you're right, there are biases that work their way into everything we do publish, our ownership, our advertisers, the personal biases of the editors and journalists. But I would say that the basic thing is that, or the fundamental distinction between what we publish and what we don't publish is that there's a public record and there's stuff that's off the record. And there's a lot of truths we simply don't publish. Not because we don't want to, not because it's not true, but simply because we can't. And the reason we can't is because it's not part of the public record. Journalists spend a great deal of time with sources talking on what they call background, which is they just sort of talk and talk and talk, and they'll tell you, for instance, one of our reporters spent 2 hours talking to an executive with Nortel, which is a company which is also in bankruptcy protection. 2 hours, not a single word of it was on the record. And so he came back, and the question is, okay, now what can we write? And what we can write amounts to cobbling together quotes from observers and analysts and facts and so on. And so this distinction between the public record and what we actually know to be true is, I've sort of personally come to see as the fundamental question of journalism, which is, and because there are papers, one of our competitors uses a great deal of anonymous sources, the Globe and Mail, invariably puts stories in the front using anonymous sources. We don't, as a rule. So I would say that distinction, we're not so much servants of the truth, we're servants of the public record, which is something quite different. And an exploration of that, I think, would be very interesting. It's something I don't have a proper handle on yet, what the public record means as opposed to the truth.
Well, that's really interesting. I haven't thought very much about that. But so I'm curious, when you... The Globe and Mail uses a lot of anonymous sources. If you don't credit the source, would your paper also, if you were willing to use anonymous sources, then the stuff that's off the record, you can publish, or would that be a violation of your trust with the source as well?
It's tricky. There are things that sources will say that you can then write. If the source is high enough, for instance, if an executive from, say, Nortel says, we lost $8 billion, sometimes we'll just write it. Nortel lost $8 billion last year, a company that used to have a valuation of blah, 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 blah. We'll just write it. We won't attribute it. We'll just state it as a fact because the source is highly placed or we have enough confidence in it being true that we'll just say it. sources will also speak. They'll say you can attribute it to a high placed source in the government, but you can't speak by name. That's what the Globe and Mail does a lot of. And then actually saying something that a reporter that a source told you off the record and then going on the record with it, that happens almost never because that source will never speak to you again.
By naming the source, you mean, or
even if you just write it.
If
someone says something to
it.
You off the record and you write it, right. Even don't trip, they'll go crazy. I mean, there's the off the record on the record distinction is not a legal distinction; it's an ethical distinction, and so they'll just never speak to your paper again. So,
I haven't seen enough. I keep thinking of I.F. Stone, the American journalist. I don't know if he's a familiar name in Canada, who wrote something called I.F. Stone's Weekly during the Vietnam War, and you know worked completely on through documents. And I don't think he ever spoke to anybody. And I mean, I guess the question is how much could you find out that way? Is that just not a realistic method for daily journalism for
you
most...
You mean through documents and so on?
Through documents.
Oh, a great deal. I mean, a great deal of the stories we get are not sort of going out and reporting things we saw or things we did, just doing access to information requests and getting documents. You know, you just ask for the communications between a minister and some bureaucrats or internal reports on audits of whatever, right? And you just write those up because those are on the record. And so on. We can talk afterwards. It's actually quite interesting.
Hi, my name is Mike Dorischer. I'm a Canada-U.S. Fulbright scholar from the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and I'm at McGill this year. If capitalism isn't helping our media get at the truth, or is failing the media's ability to do that, and if there's too many strings, too many concerns with the government's intervention, potentially, you say, how is it that at least you can work with journalism students and journalists to get closer to the truth that our audience members believe to be the truth? The disconnect between what the audience thinks of as the truth and the media professionals think of as the truth, and it's leading to declines in the audience numbers, maybe not to the as much to the extent here in Canada as in the United States, but the same demographic. Well, the Washington Post even has lost 15-20% of its readership in the last 10 years. And there's obviously a disconnect between what the audience feels is essential for them to know their information and what the established media are providing. So how can we reconcile those versions of the truth?
I'm not sure it's necessarily the truth that people want. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a good answer to this question. I mean, one question is whether the audience that is lost is getting their news online, for example, for free, but still following what we might think of as, the important stories rather than, simply celebrity gossip. I don't know if you have evidence about that.
Well, I think there's a generation gap in that, certainly. I don't think a lot of young people are reading the same or watching stories about the same issues that older people are.
I don't know. I'm sure that people must have done studies of this. I mean, we have this stereotype of the younger generation, but at least, in the U.S., we also have, evidence of greater commitment, political interest, and, the recent election being some evidence of that. So, I'm not sure how much of it is that young people aren't following these issues, or that they just get there. I know my kids, my son, even when he's who's 24, at our house, and the newspaper, the print newspaper is there. He's reading it online, but he's reading it. He's not typical either, but...
Thank you. Namir and Annie from the CRTC. I know the CRTC came up in a lot of discussion so far. Thank you for your presentation. I'm interested to know, because you highlighted the domain of the internet, and in a way, the citizen journalism and the diversity of voices that are created on the internet. But on the other hand, you highlighted the notion of authenticity, and that the public, in a way, to get better information, they may go back to trusted sources from major corporations that are in the conventional broadcasting system. So the question I have is, does internet lead to a better diversity of voices, or does it lead to the same diversity of voices that is on the conventional broadcasting system?
Well, I think that's a really hard question. I mean, I think, again, if you consider the whole internet, it does lead to a greater diversity of voices, and there's just an amazing amount out there on any subject you care to name. But I don't know, you know, if you were to compare how many hits does a particular source get. Clearly, the conventional sources get more, and maybe should get more. So, it's partly that it's too early to tell what's going to happen. I mean, you know, every week there's something new, and now it's Twitter, and I think we're too close to tell how it's going to turn out, if that idea makes sense, because it's not, you know, it's just going to keep evolving. But I don't know. I mean, I think it is very paradoxical that on the one hand there's this enormous diversity and you can find so much out there that was completely unavailable, but on the other hand, if you don't know how to trust these sources, I still mostly look at the New York Times. Actually, one of the main things I do online these days is I look at the top emailed articles on the New York Times website, and I often find things that I hadn't looked at before, because, as I say, I don't read the paper itself that carefully. And so, in a way, that's a democratic approach, because you're looking at what other people found to be most interesting. Of course, that's, you know, that has its problems too, because, you know, there's a bandwagon effect. Yeah, I looked at the most emailed articles. I send them to other people, so those are the articles that get seen, and there's this snowball effect, and that may not necessarily reflect quality. Of course, it's also true that I would say half to two-thirds of those articles on the most emailed articles are either features, you know, recipes for health, or else they're opinion pieces, op-ed pieces, and they're not even straight news stories. But so I don't have a good answer, as usual.
Thank you. So we are running out of time, so it will be our last question. So thanks a lot, Judith.
Thank you.